What is up, basketball fans? Welcome to the NBA Outlet. I'm your host, Nick Fay. With me, as always, Corey Waldron, regular guest on the show, Jack Manuel. What's up, fellas? How we doing?
It is unseasonably cold in Melbourne, but it's always hot when I talk hoops with Corey.
I'm angry, boys. I'm angry. I did a lot of yelling in that fourth quarter. Lot of yelling at the team, at the announcers. God damn the Boston Celtics.
Yeah, I would definitely yell at the announcers. They're definitely the most annoying announcers in the NBA, but that's for a whole nother day. But Corey, we'll let you get right into it. I won't even give my spiel for iTunes and whatever. What were your thoughts on that game? Obviously, Kyrie hitting the game winner and the Pacers, you know, having a gritty game.
Yeah, I mean, the first quarter, the Celtics had a sense of urgency, you can say. They only had one turnover in the first quarter. The Pacers had four. The Celtics were hitting all their shots. They just played with a lot of energy. It was 35-25 at the end of the first quarter, and it kind of felt to me like the Celtics were going to start running away with it. Then the second quarter, the Pacers do what they do best. They took care of the basketball. They had no turnovers in the second quarter, and then they forced seven turnovers in the second quarter, helped them get back into the game. Bogdanović had 18 at halftime. Then the third quarter, the Pacers and Celtics, pretty much neither one of these two teams could miss. Both teams got extremely hot. I know TJ Leaf in the second quarter, too. Credit to him. He came off the bench, and he had 10 points, I think, in like 6 minutes or 7 minutes. And that really helped the Pacers get come alive. And then in the third quarter, both teams just trading buckets. Bogdanović had 25 to end the third. And something that really bothered me in the fourth quarter is he didn't touch the ball. He didn't take a shot until there was under 5 minutes remaining in the game after being 7 for 12 for 25 points after three. Why they decided to have the offense move away from him, I'm not really sure. That's not why they lost, obviously. They had plenty of chances to win that game. But the fourth quarter became a slugfest. I thought there were a lot of gritty plays, a lot of hustle. Thaddeus Young was perplexing for me. There was a lot of moments that I loved him in that fourth quarter, hustling, diving for loose balls. He missed a wide open layup after driving by Baines, which killed me. He took a three over top of Baines that was questionable off a one look pass with like 20 seconds left on the shot clock. Didn't understand why he forced that. And then on the last play of the game, Kyrie has the game winning layup, and it just looked like nobody on the Pacers knew who should have helped. It looked like everybody on the Pacers could have helped. I think Thaddeus Young, who was guarding Baines, who was in the corner, probably should have cut off Kyrie Irving on that drive. But, in that kind of situation, it is what it is. Marcus Smart hit like a rainbow 3-2.
That was crazy three.
Shot clock winding down. But Bogdanović played good defense on it. But it is what it is. And also foul trouble. The Celtics got to the line a lot in that fourth quarter, especially right when the Pacers started to kind of get a little bit loose with the ball. Turnover-wise, the Celtics took advantage and got to the line. Sabonis, I know, had like 3 fouls in a row in the span of like 2 minutes. And it kind of just, the Celtics won. They're the better team on paper. This probably is going to be a playoff. This is a playoff series. I think we all know that. Now the Celtics lead the season series 2-1. They have the final matchup on April 5th in Indiana. And, I'm okay with a playoff series with these two teams. I don't know what else to say. The Celtics just, they slightly outdid the Pacers tonight. But both these teams play really hard.
This is obviously a likely series, Corey. Do you see it going 6 or 7, almost fait accompli?
I see it going maybe 5-6. I don't want to say 7, because I think for the Pacers, I had a tweet earlier tonight. When the Pacers have Oladipo, they're an A-minus team, I think. When the Pacers don't have Oladipo, they're a solid B-level team. The Celtics, I think, on paper and in the 7-game series, that's an A team, which is the talent, the depth, the coaching. That's who they are. I think the Pacers being a B-level team, you can beat a team like that on a good night, but you pretty much have to be perfect. That's turnover-wise. You can't afford to get over turnovers. I know that the Celtics, I think they had like 34 or 36 fast break points this game. You just can't let the Celtics get out in transition like that. They're going to kill you. I know they had 25 through 3. So for me, I just don't think the Pacers, in instance, have enough offense to really maintain a deep series run against the Celtics, because they really, I think, have to be just about perfect.
What would you say is like the matchup maybe the Pacers could take advantage of in a series, if any?
Against the Celtics?
Yeah.
I mean, realistically, it is Thaddeus Young. If they're going to play, I mean, Aaron Baines, I know, played a season high or career high minutes tonight for the Celtics. And Thaddeus Young really toasted him a couple times off the dribble. So I think that's a matchup if they're going to try and play big, because obviously the Pacers are Sabonis and Turner and Thad. That's a pretty big three they have there in terms of size. So if the Celtics are going to play a guy like Baines, it's attacking Baines. Collison in the second half did a great job attacking Kyrie Irving off the dribble, you know, exploiting Kyrie, who I know Jack has gotten on me before about saying he's a good defender, but Collison really exploited him at times. I think that would be probably – there's not very many guys you can attack on the Celtics. You know, this is a pretty sound team defensively, but I think Baines on Thaddeus Young is probably the one matchup I would try to attack more.
Jack, any matchups you like for the Pacers perspective?
I was going to say, as an outsider looking in, it's more of like a collective, whereas this Pacers team has the chemistry probably better than any other team in the NBA, similar to what the Celtics had last season in the absence of their sort of two stars. And they're playing, you know, to that sort of potential right now. They're playing at a level that is incredibly consistent, whereas the Celtics, you don't know what you get on any sort of night, and their consistency has been, you know, shaky at best. So I think the Pacers as a collective have, you know, from 1 through 9, as much talent, as much as Corey grades them, you know, B+, A-, whatever it is. I think on their given night, they can play like an A+ team, because they are one of the best defensive teams in the NBA. Nate McMillan has transformed himself as a coach. So I think it's more the collective unit in Indiana that can probably battle and probably get an ascendancy over this Celtics team, who is quite stacked, but, you know, their chemistry issues and, you know, who gets the shot and stuff. Could you imagine if Kyrie didn't get that last shot? We'd be hearing about it in the media right now.
Yeah, and then the Pacers won. I thought Corey brought up a really good point, the transition defense. And, you know, that's an area we've seen the Celtics struggle this season, where they have to do half-court offense and they'll take too many threes, miss threes, settle for jump shots. If you let them get out in transition, especially with some of the athletes like a Jaylen Brown, a Jason Tatum, a Marcus Smart, it'll be easy offense. So I think that's a correctable area for the Pacers moving forward, obviously, in a likely series.
Yeah. And also, I mean, I know I already mentioned this when I did like the little quick recap. Bogdanović has got to, with how well he's played. I know he going into this game, he was averaging 31 points per game in the last two games. That was against Denver and Oklahoma.
I was in Brooklyn, bro.
So I think for the Pacers too, especially in the fourth quarter, without a guy like Oladipo who you can rely offense from, when you got a guy like Bogdanović who's been playing as well as he's playing this year, you got to give him more touches in crunch time and in the fourth quarter. You got to let a guy who can shoot the three and be a more diverse offensive weapon kind of lead the charge at times. Because I think that's an issue with the Pacers too, especially in the fourth quarter, is because his team, as Jack has mentioned, it's kind of like a team-based effort. They don't necessarily rely on guys heavily in crunch time. And I think, you know, not that I think you have to do it all the time, but there are certain nights, and tonight kind of felt like it, where you needed to rely on somebody to get you a bucket, and they just didn't do that down the stretch.
Do you think his ankle was bothering him? Jaylen Brown, like, straight up stepped on his ankle. Like, I'm surprised it wasn't a more serious injury.
Yeah, I mean, it was worrisome. Don't get me wrong. The minute I saw it, I was like, here we go. This could be just everything right here. I'm sure it did bother him. I know he hobbled off, and he actually – I don't think he shot the ball the rest of the game, actually. So it's very possible that was something that affected him. He did play good defense on Marcus Smart, I think, the next possession, and he looked okay on that.
Jack, any thoughts on the injury? I don't know if you saw it or not. You know, Jaylen, I was like concerned that like he broke his ankle for a quick second because he landed. It must have been a light step.
Yeah, it didn't look overtly serious. I mean, you sort of worry as soon as someone clutches any part of their body immediately. But the fact that he was able to walk off his own accord, wasn't necessarily limping, was walking on both feet, was able to put pressure on it, shows that, you know, I mean, if we're comparing it to, say, a recent ankle injury in Giannis, you know, if tomorrow was a playoff game, Giannis would play. I think the same thing would be said of Boyan heading against Orlando. Maybe they take some precautionary measures. You know, they've obviously got that. It's the battle of the seeds, I guess. So it depends on what you sort of prioritize there. I think health is always going to be the priority at this point in the season, overseeding. But I wouldn't be surprised if he does miss a game or two.
And one more thing I can say, too, about the Pacers, too. Miles Turner, lack of involvement in the fourth quarter. He was 3 of 5 from three going into the fourth quarter. 3 of 6 from three going into the fourth quarter. Didn't take a single three, finished the game with 15-11. He looked pretty good for most of the game, especially rebounding wise. But I still don't understand the lack of involvement offensively, especially when he was getting the deep ball effectively tonight. I think he should have got more looks. And that's also probably a matchup too the Pacers can exploit, because you have Miles Turner being an outside threat that really expands the paint. My board just fell off my wall, my sketchboard. it really expands the paint. If you can pull Al Horford out of the paint, I think that helps Pacers' chances.
Yeah, definitely open up any type of spacing. Would you guys agree this will probably be the best first-round matchup in the Eastern Conference?
Yes. I think that it's probably, you know, whoever the Bucks first in the eighth seed, Orlando, Miami, Nets, whoever it is, that'll be probably. But I guess if the Pistons go to seven and they somehow land up in a matchup against Toronto, I think that'll be pretty entertaining with all the storylines with Dwayne Casey and the history there. Could be pretty fun as well. But I think this probably is the one that extends the most, which is why I sort of think it'll be a seven-game series.
What do you think, Corey?
I think this is probably the most talent in a first round series we're going to have in the East. I think maybe Jack, if it goes seven, I think if the Pacers get home court, if the Pacers don't get home court, I think this is a 5 or 6 game series. But this is going to be a very tight series. And there's already, you know, the first game of the year against the Celtics Pacers, Oladipo hit the game winner. The Celtics blew them out in the second game. Then we had this close game. These teams also, I don't want to say that they don't like each other, but they definitely play with a little bit more energy whenever they match up. I'm not sure if it's because the media constantly talks about this playoff series possibly, and some people have been giving the Pacers a shot in this series. So maybe that's another reason why the Celtics seem to be playing a little bit more edge. But I think this would be a very good playoff series.
Yeah, you could argue these games right now are like a playoff game because they're fighting for seeding. Obviously, seeding's not super important, but they would like to win the game and get home court. But yeah. Any final thoughts on Boston and Indiana before we move on?
Kyrie's a bad man.
Can't let him get shots like that at the end of a game.
No. Yeah. And especially when you know he's not going to pass.
Yeah, he could really be the difference maker. You know, it's when me and Corey, we got a little bit of guff for having him at number 9 in our top 50 series, but these are the sort of reasons why, because he can prove it. He's one of the best clutch time performers in the NBA, probably of the past sort of decade or so. And he's done it in a playoff stage as well. So I think Wes Matthews, whoever is guarding him in this series, that is likely to happen, is going to have a really tough time, because I think Kyrie really wants to step up and is really going to want to make a statement. It seemed like a really quiet 30 points for him, but he's tremendously talented.
Yeah, I think definitely. That closing ability makes the top 10 pick from you guys obviously sit a little bit better. Now, moving on from there, Nick Cuvallo had a great article that just dropped on OTG. Can anyone challenge the Warriors? Now, he looked at the East and he looked at the West. We'll start with the East. You know, we had the Raptors, the Bucks, the Sixers, and the Celtics. And he had the Raptors at number 1. Do you think that's a fair take?
I've been quite high on the Raptors myself. I remember when we did this roundtable and the Raptors got a lot of love. You know, there was a lot of teams that got, you know, varying amounts of love, and it seemed pretty consistent. And Nick's gotten quite in depth in terms of the reasons for and against all these sort of teams in the East and West. He might have a little bit of bias being a Raptors fan himself, but he's also very measured in his biases, so to speak. So the reason why I've always thought the Raptors have been one of the number one contenders is plain and simple Kawhi Leonard. He's done it against this team before Zaza Pachulia stuck his own foot out and injured him, and you know the rest is history with his time in San Antonio. So I think that is probably what separates them to an extent. And they might not have had playoff success. Obviously, there's those demons in the past, blah 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 blah. But it's a completely different team. Danny Green has had playoff success in San Antonio as well. The reason why there's question marks about the Bucks is because, you know, they filtered out in the first round last season. Obviously, a completely different lineup now, completely different coach, despite the fact that Jason Kidd somehow he's going to get another head coaching job. I don't understand how, but that's a discussion. Maybe we could have a little bit later on. But I think the Bucks, if they can prove it in this first round, Nick might have to rescind these thoughts, because Giannis is doing some pretty awesome things. Their health, Nikola Mirotic and Malcolm Brogdon, I think will have an effect. But the Raptors are low-key doing some nice things. They're just going to have that chemistry going, and Kawhi playing every night. It's going to be fascinating to watch.
I think everybody knows from my stance on this podcast throughout the year, I'm still going with the Bucks as the biggest threat to the Warriors in the East right now. Now, yes, is slightly dampered, so maybe I would move the Raptors up because the Bucks obviously don't have Malcolm Brogdon and Nikola Mirotic is out currently. But I think overall, when the Bucks are healthy, I love the defensive versatility. They are the number one ranked defensive rating. The number one defensive rating in the NBA currently. Their offense is fantastic. Giannis Antetokounmpo. And today I was looking at MVP numbers and like just kind of like comparing Harden onto the Kumpo. I'm not talking about the MVP race, but looking at just like the per 36 numbers for onto the Kumpo, because keep in mind, this guy doesn't play heavy minutes. He's only playing 32 minutes per game. And per 36 minutes, he would average 30 points and almost 14 rebounds a game on 6.5 assists. So I think when you have Antetokounmpo playing those boatload of minutes, and he's already kind of rested to this point to a degree, I still like the Bucks matchup-wise in a seven-game series against the Warriors. And then, you know, the East has some just really top-level teams in terms of, like, starting lineups that match up with the Warriors.
Yeah, I could definitely see the argument for the Bucks, but I've been, like, pro-Raptors all season. One thing I like about the Raptors is their small ball versatility that they have. You know, the guys that can go out there, they can play Pascal Siakam at center if they need to in a series against the Warriors, if they're going to throw Draymond out there. And they have guys they can throw at KD. They don't just have to throw Kawhi. They can throw Siakam at him a little bit. And I just like the depth they have. And, you know, obviously there's always a talk about the Raptors hadn't been able to do it in the playoffs, but now they bring a guy like Kawhi. They bring a guy like Danny Green. They bring a guy like Marc Gasol. All have playoff experience and more playoff success than probably what the Raptors have had. So I think that really pushes them probably to another level. But I don't mind the Bucks. I am a little concerned about some of their players maybe being exposed in a Golden State series. You know, Corey and I have brought this up before. I think Brook Lopez would have a really tough time against the Warriors.
I agree. Honestly, he's a crucial part of their offense. The fact that he shoots, what, 7 threes a game, if not more at this point in the season. So you lose that kind of 3-point threat, and, you know, who knows what the Bucks offense looks like, because that's been a crucial part of their offense.
If he's nailing threes, though, like you get him hot early, you run some early plays for him, then you can turn it on its head. I'm always one that buys into conventional wisdom, like you guys are sort of saying. But at the same time, all these sort of bigs like Rudy Gobert, Clint Capella, they get played out of these series. But if they're making dunks, if they're making screens, if they're individually playing well and making an impact on the court, then they force the Golden State Warriors to make it changes to their own sort of schemes. Despite the fact that, you know, that death lineup is one of the greatest lineups in the history of the game and has changed the face of the game as we see it, so to speak, I don't buy into it as much. I think that there's still, you know, there's a reason that he can have an impact. You know, whether he's playing against DeMarcus Cousins in the starting lineup, I think he would play DeMarcus Cousins off the court because DeMarcus can't move laterally whatsoever. So obviously how they sort of match up with their bigs will be a fascinating sort of watch if they're lucky enough to get there.
I think that Golden State would have an easier time adjusting to Lopez knocking down threes than the Bucks would if they were trying to expose Lopez every time, you know, in the half-court offense, getting him in an isolation situation. I love Brook. He's probably one of my all-time favorite players. You know, obviously his time with the Nets. And I think if they just got him in open space, and even Cousins, like at the percentage he's at, not obviously 100%, I think I would still feel pretty good about him defending Brook. It's not like Brook's really spending much time inside the paint. You could probably even throw KD on him at this point because he's just not going inside quite as much as he has in the past.
But if he's staying on the perimeter, then he forces DeMarcus out, and then that opens
up. DeMarcus. They don't even let's be realistic here. Do they need DeMarcus on the court? Not really.
No, but we know Steve Kerr and his sort of history when it comes to the center position. Obviously, they've got Andrew Bogut now, who they could stick out there as well. And I mean, I'm not a big fan of Kevon Looney. I think he's a good-ish player. But in terms of that, yeah, if they're going to play, you know, 40 minutes with Draymond Green at center, then so be it. But I think that I don't know how often that will happen. It should happen if it's a final series, but you know, Steve Kerr has made some questionable decisions. He's a great coach, but he still makes some questionable choices when it comes to that center position. And I think that Brook Lopez, you know, if he could drag out those guys, and that opens up the lane for Giannis, who can really beast down low if there's any sort of space. And I think that Giannis could, you know, have a real impact. I think he could be, you know, a Golden State killer, so to speak. If there's the fact that he can just get into the lane at will, I think if he can make his presence felt. I think that this is the most susceptible the Warriors have ever been to defeat over the past 4 years or so. I think that's not a hot take whatsoever. This was a hot take or shot fake, but they do look a little bit wary, despite the fact that Kevin Durant is just making shots left, right, and center, as I did a little bit of a breakdown on OTG.
Yeah, shout out to you for an excellent thread, and also shout out to KD for just being disgusting and knocking down threes that were like, it almost looked like it was about to be a block shot, and he's still knocking down like swoosh. Like it's kind of crazy. And that's what's kind of worried about the Warriors is like, yeah, they're not playing great right now, but what happens if they just turn the switch in a first-round series or someone really pisses them off and all of a sudden they're just cooking?
You could say that you could, I'll play devil's advocate. You could argue the fact that, you know, what happens if Kevin Durant doesn't get enough shots and, you know, Stephen Curry and Draymond Green, they're arguing they lose a game or two. I think that it goes both ways, as much as it's a lot easier to think of the fact because we have the history behind it. But on Kevin Durant, do you guys think he's getting enough credit in the sort of MVP race? Because I think a lot of people are sort of looking under the radar when it comes to him. Stephen Curry's probably... A lot of people have him higher in the MVP race in the sort of top five standing, so to speak. But at the same time, a lot of other people are putting him as, you know, the best player in the league today due to, you know, what's happening with LeBron James and everything there in LA. What are your thoughts on KD this season, fellas?
Well, I can say the best player debate and the MVP debate, they don't go hand to hand to me, especially not this year. This is just a different debate. And then the MVP race for me, like it's Antetokounmpo and Harden, and then you can tell me someone's third, fourth, and fifth. I really don't care because that you're playing for third place in my book. Like I think number two, the one and two guys are just so far ahead that I think, you know, you can make the, and I'm sure Kevin Durant's in it. He probably would be in my top five along with, you know, Joel Embiid might be in there. Paul George, I think, would surely be in there. You can debate. Jokic would be around there. Like, I don't know, because I'm being honest. I really haven't thought much outside of Harden after Antetokounmpo. There was a brief 2 weeks where I had like Paul George in mind, and then that kind of went back down to earth. Like, I just am not looking outside of that. But I think anytime Durant, you know, has a huge performance, we're just kind of like reminded, like, oh wow, yeah, this is like a once in a like generational player who's, you know, an MVP caliber player and likely going to be the best player in the world very soon.
I think the narrative when KD signed with Golden State was pretty much like, all right, nobody on Golden State's going to win an MVP anymore because they're all so good. You know, not to say that's fair, but I think that's a narrative that just kind of came with it. So even though KD might be playing at an MVP level, people will be like, well, he plays with Steph, he plays with Clay, and now they have DeMarcus Cousins. Oh, yeah, and Draymond Green. So, like, I think he'll never be able to win another MVP probably in Golden State unless there was, like, a serious injury. Not to say he doesn't deserve it, but I think, obviously, MVP is so narrative-driven.
And I'll say – sorry, I just want to piggyback up real quick, Jack. I'd also say, like, that one stretch with Curry being out where the Warriors struggled with Kevin Durant leading the charge kind of thing, I think that just kind of dampened maybe his season to a degree. Like, not that he hasn't been playing great afterwards since Curry came back, but there was that stretch without Curry where we kind of all thought, like, oh, once again, Curry's the most impactful player on the Warriors. Even with Durant and Clay there, they can't seem to win games.
I don't think he was that bad. I think it was Clay at that time who was shooting, you know, sub 40%, and Draymond wasn't making shots at all. I think Kevin Durant was actually the only good player over that stretch. You know, the fact that they were still able to win some games, and I think, you know, we hold him to a much higher standard. But Corey mentioned the fact that he would have him higher than Steph in his MVP race, Nick. I mean, it's a more philosophical debate than anything. It's not really, you know, going to change anything, but I'm just curious to hear, would you have him above Steph in your sort of top five, whatever, so if you were to sort of rank the MVP candidates?
I'll just be really annoying and say I have him tied.
That's a cop-out if I've ever heard it.
I said I was going to be annoying. I mean, like, it's hard to say because, like, if you look at the stats and, like, the wins with Steph there, and obviously I think one thing about Steph, and I've always felt this way, is that his leadership and, like, what he brings to the team, like, his morale is just such a boost for everybody. It seems like, you know, you hear a lot, like, oh, this guy is so great off the court. But it really seems like everybody loves Steph. Like, I can't think of one player who said something negative about him.
I think LeBron was really peeved with him during that sort of when he sort of the Steph come up was happening 16, 17, 14, 15, when they sort of really started rising. And now people were questioning, you know, LeBron's sort of, you know, stranglehold on the NBA. There were murmurings happening. I remember specifically that LeBron was pretty pissed. He was just like, this guy's the face of the league now. This guy just chucking threes. Like, are you serious? So I think LeBron probably isn't the biggest fan. We know the whole, you know, Chris, it was a wedding. Was it Harrison Barnes' wedding or who, someone's wedding?
Oh, yeah.
So there was that whole drama as well. So I think Steph gets a little bit petty as well. I'm a big fan of his. I think that everyone is. He's a lovely family man. He's got all the Christian values, blah, blah, blah. but at the same time, I think there's some people that will say he's too clean. You know, let's get a little bit of edge to him. But at times he does. He's just a very lovable dude. And personally, I probably have KD above him just because he's played more games. Despite the fact that I think, like sort of Corey mentioned, Curry's more impactful to this team and always will be because this is Steph's team and has been ever since Steve Kerr arrived.
Fun tidbit, me and Stephen Curry share the same birthday.
Happy birthday to Corey Waldron and Stephen Curry.
If you only could have got those shooting jeans.
And a little bit taller. A little bit taller, yeah. Too, would have helped.
He's only my height. He's our height. Mine and Nick's height. He's like 6'3 or something.
Yeah, well, for guys who are like, guys, I'm going to tell you guys a secret. I'm not 6 foot. I'm 5'11, okay?
You've been lying to me my whole life.
I went to the doctor. They were like, yo, you're 5'11. I was like, you're lying.
Oh, come on.
It's like, how can I stretch myself out? Like, no. Yeah. So, we could debate about this. I think it'll be easier for KD to win MVP if he leaves, obviously, next year and goes to a team and takes him to a 50 win and to a conference final or something like that, which I think is probably doable, especially if he goes to the East.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think KD, I think he's probably one of the most underappreciated superstars in the history of the game. And that's saying something. A guy I think I was going to go down as top 10 of all time. And I mean, I was in my formative years when MJ was sort of taking over, but KD is the most pure scorer I've ever seen. And just imagine having that confidence just to be able to know, yeah, I can get a shot over you. Doesn't matter if you're 7 foot, because he is 7 foot. Like, we've seen the pictures of him standing next to like DeMarcus Cousins, and he's like taller than him at Team USA. Just imagine being able to like have like the handle and everything. It's just, it's insane. He's an absolute marvel. And I think, you know, if the whole narrative, it was funny. I think people are starting to talk about it a little bit now. I think I saw it on Twitter. When is Giannis going to turn like in a similar way that KD sort of has? Because, you know, you the real MVP, KD, was absolutely beloved. And a few years later, obviously, it was the Golden State Warriors move.
Right.
But yeah. Giannis, it's just fun to sort of debate. Similar with Joel Embiid. Joel Embiid's starting to finally get a little bit of hate after, you know, the sort of comeback story from injury. But it'll be fascinating to see if Giannis ever gets that. But for now, and I'm going to be talking about it on JBT in terms of the face of the league thing with Giannis as well, but discussion for another day, I guess.
Yeah, and I think
the thing
with the narrative for like KD, obviously, that made him underappreciated is the fact he went to Golden State. If he stayed in OKC, I think everybody still loves him. If he went to, let's say, San Antonio that year, if he went to Boston or one of these other teams, I still think he'd probably be a little bit more loved. And then in a Joel Embiid aspect, he kind of like loves to hate. Like, he likes to be annoying. He likes to kind of annoy you, the players, the fans, whatever it is. Like, he just has a little bit of annoyance about him, where I think Giannis doesn't really do that. Obviously, he plays with an edge. He's talked about not training with other guys, being like KG and Kobe. But I think he's almost more likable in a sense, just because he doesn't try to annoy anyone. And then I don't know if you guys saw the video today of like him hugging that little girl after she drew pictures of him.
So cute.
Yeah, like that was like my favorite video of the day. I'm feeling like a dad. I'm getting old.
So cute.
I just want to say that I think like the narrative changes whenever a player starts winning a lot. That's when you find out he's either going to get loved or you're going to hate him. It basically, when a player reaches a certain level, like when LeBron started winning all the time, it was either, all right, I love LeBron, or now I'm completely against LeBron. Then it was the Curry aspect became the same thing. You either loved Curry or you hated Curry. So but I think players just kind of go through that.
I don't think Steph has lost it, though, like you sort of said, Corey. I think that Steph has stayed beloved. And yes, you get hated when you win. But I think, you know, I agree. I think that it'll start happening for Giannis soon enough, if they're lucky enough to, you know, be, if they win a championship, you know, the year after, he's going to get a lot more sort of, you know, probably critics and haters, whatever you want to call them. But at the same time, he doesn't do, like we've sort of been talking about, he doesn't do much wrong off the court. On the court, he's an absolute anomaly. He's one of the greatest physical specimens we've ever seen. It'll be fascinating to see that sort of turn and when it happens, whether it happens in this postseason or the next postseason. Because, you know, championships aren't given. And, you know, despite the fact that Milwaukee are absolutely on a tear right now, it might not happen in the fact that, you know, if he doesn't win it this year, then he might not ever win one.
You either die a hero or you live long enough to see yourself become the villain.
Great line. Great line. With great power comes great responsibility.
Yes.
Another great line.
All right. But we want to move on from the MVP talk and get to the Western Conference of Nick's article, where he brought up OKC, Houston, and Denver. I believe he still had Houston at the top, you know, OKC as kind of like a low-key option, and then Denver as the least serious threat out of those teams and probably the Eastern Conference teams as well.
I think there's only one legitimate threat right now. I was big on the OKC bandwagon because I was big on them in the preseason as well, but they've sort of dropped off a little bit. I think they're playing Denver right now. I'm not sure what the score is. I have to check into that. It was quite close early on. But Houston have sort of, you know, solidified themselves as the second best team in the West. James Harden is probably the main reason for that. But Clint Capella is back and healthy, which certainly helps. Having that pick and roll threat, really good screener. And he monstered Nikola Jokic the other night as well. Chris Paul's back in really good form. You know, we would have had him higher in our top 50 for Corey and myself if he was playing at this level for the entire season and was healthy. So, and they've got all these sort of ancillary pieces that are starting to do a little bit. You know, Iman Shumpert, Daniel House, all these sort of guys off the bench, Gerald Green, you know, PJ Tucker's, you know, incredibly consistent for them. So I think that they've now got, you know, a little bit there that can, you know, they're not the Houston Rockets of last year because that team was historically great. Like one of the best individual regular season teams of all time. They just still missed that probably one wing who can probably defend a KD when, you know, it comes down to it because, you know, is it Shumpert? Is it PJ Tucker who's been playing a lot of center? And Eric Gordon's form has been really shoddy this season as well.
It's like yeah. I think, you know, the getting House back on the team, you know, obviously there was a talk about him possibly not signing because he wanted the NBA contract and not having that possibility. I thought that was really big for the Rockets to get him for their final push. Like, I think he's an underrated aspect. I might even like adding him more to the NBA roster than adding Iman Shumpert and Kenneth Faried.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I think of these three teams, Houston is, I think Nick's right, Houston probably is the biggest threat. OKC, as you mentioned, Jack, they've kind of squandered since the All-Star break. Obviously, Westbrook's playing fantastic now. He can actually shoot again, which is great to see.
Great article on that.
Yep, but everybody else seems to be taking the dip. And then Denver, I just don't think they're there yet. I think they're just too young. I just don't think they match up right with the Warriors just yet. Houston, I still think they're more of a threat to the Warriors this year than last year. I'm not saying that they're a better team than last year. I just think, as Jack mentioned earlier in the show, the fact that the Warriors just seem more beatable this year between chemistry issues, between just the fact that going for a three-peat is hard to do. It wears on you mentally, physically. That's just another element. And like you guys mentioned, I mean, Daniel House has been a really nice addition. He hit a step back the other night that was James Harden-esque. Harden, obviously, fantastic, 36 points per game. Can he do it still in a deep playoff run? Can he do it in a game seven? Can he continue that kind of iso ball? His usage rate is 40%, which is ridiculous.
It's like Westbrook in his MVP, yeah.
It's absurd. But I do like the Rockets. I think they have just a chip on their shoulder too. And when it comes to the Warriors, they just play them differently. It's one of those teams that you just get like an extra amount of energy for. You take an extra like shot of adrenaline before the game almost. So I like that aspect of things. But as you guys mentioned, Eric Gordon is going to be like a huge X factor. Because if the Rockets want to actually beat the Warriors, they need the three-point shooting. And Eric Gordon has got to be a 35 to 40% three-point shooter, and he's been dreadful at times.
Yeah, they need him to be efficient and average like 20 in the series. Like, Gordon is like the type of guy that can almost play at like a fringe all-star level, or he can play like a below-average starter. So it's like, yeah. What are we going to get in the series? What's going to happen with him? I'm going to be really interested to see what happens with Harden. I almost think Harden hurts himself because he's so like interested in playing every game where like it would make a ton of sense for him to rest a couple games before the playoffs.
Yeah.
Yeah. What were you guys' thoughts on the fact that, you know, I love the mentality of, you know, I'm a hooper and I'm going to hoop until I can't. But is that where you need a guy like Mike D'Antoni to step in and make the executive decision, Daryl Morey, go down and go, look, we know it, mate. Giannis could be missing a few games as well. So this could be the perfect time to just have a couple of days rest and, you know, get a little bit fresher because what matters is the postseason. And that's the narrative for James Harden that is against him going forward in terms of he is already an all-timer. We're witnessing some all-time greats currently in the league. But if he can't prove it in this postseason, you know, I think I remember doing a piece, I can't remember if it was for OTG or some other outlet, and just that every single game won in the series in last year's playoffs, he was great. But in those in the other games, he really tapered off quite a bit. So he starts hot. It's just whether he can maintain that consistency.
Yeah, I agree. I think it would just make sense for somebody in Houston to be like, hey, James, you've been awesome. You've been awesome for like the last couple seasons. You've been playing at an MVP level. Like, you don't have anything to prove in the regular season. If you want to be an all-time player, and like obviously Jack already mentioned he is, but if you want to get into like that top three shooting guard rank, which you possibly could because you're putting up historical seasons, you need to have an historical postseason. And if you do that and you beat Golden State and you win a championship, that'd be the type of thing that'd be like, all right, I'll forget about the last 2 years. I'll forget about that mono block. Like, all that stuff will kind of get wiped away if you have a historical postseason and beat Golden State and kind of take them down, and then next thing you know, KD leaves, and it's like, oh, James Harden dethroned the Warriors when you look back in history. We might not think that now, but like if you look back in time, you're like, oh, Harden was a big reason they broke up.
Right. I mean, I I'm with you guys. I think realistically it makes sense for Harden to rest. I'm guessing their mentality is the fact that they're only three games out of the one seed. But like, again, like I say that, but then I look at the standings and is like playing San Antonio in the first round, like really like ideal? Is being the two seed and playing OKC the ideal matchup? Like, it doesn't even really matter what seed you get in the West, because you're going to have to go through a tough opponent anyways. But I'm with you guys. It makes sense if you're trying to win a title, if you're trying to have a deep playoff run. The fact that James Harden had to carry this load for the majority of the season as stretches with basically no help, playing a boatload of minutes. You know, I think he plays like 37 minutes per game, because per 36 minute numbers actually go down. Yeah. So I'm right there with you guys. Somebody needs to step up. Maybe it's even Chris Paul. Like, yo, I'm always hurt. Like, you need to like rest.
Don't end up like me.
Yeah, you don't want to be like me when a deep playoff run and get, you know, breaking down. So
I will play devil's advocate. Maybe Houston's like, you know what, that one seed, like last year we almost beat Golden State and we had home court. Chris Paul doesn't get hurt, we win that series. Maybe they're looking at it like, yo, that
they're not getting the one seed. I think it's a fallacy to think that they're going to get the one seed. I think that they're pretty set in three, and two or one is going to Golden State. And I think it almost works out better if they were to tank into the fourth seed. If Golden State gets second and Denver end up getting the first seed, because then they can avoid them until the latter rounds of the playoffs. And I think that works out better because it allows you to rest players. Obviously, you can't forecast things and you don't want to leave things up to chance. I think you just, like Harden said, you just play ball, but at the same time, you need to make some executive decisions that are the best for the, not just near short term, but the sort of mid short term, so to speak, next couple of months rather than next couple of days and weeks.
What would be the ideal first round matchup for Houston?
Portland? I think everyone wants Portland, don't they?
Portland, or I would even say Utah.
Utah.
Maybe not Utah. Portland or maybe the Clippers?
Yeah, I'd say the Clippers would be a decent one. I think they wouldn't really like San Antonio. I think they'd love Denver. It's hard to say. That's, you know, a bit odd to say for one of the top teams in the West, but they just body them and they just play really, really well against them. OKC wouldn't be a great matchup. And I think, you know, OKC, if they could avoid OKC, San Antonio, whatever seeding works out, and the rest of those teams, they'd feel pretty confident about. Obviously, Golden State.
Yeah, go ahead, Corey.
I'll make a hot take. I'll say if the Thunder Nuggets meet up in the first round, Thunder win that series.
Bang.
I don't hate it.
I don't really have a lot of faith in Nuggets. I think, not that they haven't had a great season. I think they're kind of like a flaky two seed. I just don't trust them in a 7-game series against teams that have actual playoff.
Well, Corey, they're right now winning by 6 points against OKC at home with 3 minutes left. So they're obviously listening to this podcast as we speak.
Of course, yeah. They all have earbuds in, right?
They got AirPods. They're rich. What do you guys think about Jokic in the playoffs? Obviously, a lot of talk this year has been about his defense. He's improved in that area. But do you think teams are really going to go at him and try to expose him in a series?
Yes, I'm going to agree with the aggressive nod that Corey is putting on right now.
We had a rock concert?
Yeah, he's listening to some music. He's listening to some bangers. A couple of good albums out this week. I think it makes the most sense to exploit what is a weakness on one team. And you exploit it to the nth degree when it comes to playoffs. When the scouting, it comes a lot of tighter and everything that is your weakness gets exploited. We spoke about Brook Lopez. Nikola Jokic probably has less defensive acumen than Brook Lopez. And that's saying something. Brook Lopez isn't, you know, an amazing, I think he's an average defender, maybe to a good defender. But Nikola Jokic is an average defender at best. But at the same time, if he can make up for it on the offensive end, you have to leave him out there. He's your star player. So I think it's going to come up to guys like Gary Harris are going to really need to step up. He's had an okay season. And Jamal Murray's going to really need to make an impact. This young sort of team and who that sort of rotation is. I really like Monte Morris. I really like their bench lineup, but their starting five has some question marks at the same time. Paul Millsap has some good experience, but you know, in Murray and in Barton and in Harris, there's some question marks there.
Yeah, you need a Harris to kind of get going. He's had a really banged up season. It feels like he's missed a lot of time. The hope would be for Denver that their team defense is able to cover him up, but playing a guy like Will Barton obviously is not ideal defensively. So, you know, they'd need Millsap and Harris to really push their game to another level to kind of protect Jokic in a sense.
I agree. I think that's the matchup you attack. I'd also say that I think in a some series, I think Denver would probably experiment with like Paul Millsap at a small ball five, just because it gives him a little bit more defense, and the fact that Millsap is just he's an all around player. He can give you a little bit of rebounding, a little bit of playmaking, a little bit of scoring. But like you guys said, you know, Jokic. I'm so bad with this goddamn name.
Jokic. I don't mind the Paul Millsap thing, though, but the funny thing is, through this entire regular season, for the most part, they're playing Plumlee and Jokic a lot together.
Yeah.
And I don't think you can't do that. Plumlee is going to get played off the floor no matter what. What other, like, all power forwards in the Western Conference right now would absolutely play him off the floor without question. You know, they have just way more athleticism, and Plumlee has been good this season, and I've liked his playmaking. I like him as a player. Obviously, he was a former Net, but I think he automatically gets exposed, and you have to upgrade a guy like, you know, Malik Beasley, Juancho Hernangómez, these sort of wings who are nice for them at the same time.
Yeah, I think in the playoffs, it tends that, like, teams just go smaller. Like, yeah, they're able to kind of make up for it by playing harder, more effort. You know, smaller guys get boxed out. You know, you pay attention to more details. Where the regular season, you know, you play two bigs, you might get that advantage. Before we move on, guys, top three picks to challenge the Warriors.
Houston. It's hard to just pick two and three. I like Houston, OKC, and Denver.
No, I mean including the East as well.
Including the East, okay.
Yeah, I'm making this hard, not too easy.
Yeah, I'll go Houston, Toronto, and Milwaukee.
I'll go Milwaukee, Boston, Houston.
Ooh, wow. Throwing some shade at Toronto.
Spicy.
I'm probably going to go the same as Jack. I would have Toronto and Houston pretty close. I might even switch them. The only argument I guess I would say is that maybe meeting them in the finals, they might be a little bit more worked if the Western Conference is able to give them any type of challenge, which is an unknown. Because they could end up dodging Houston if they get knocked out by somebody else, and then all of a sudden, I don't know if they're sweeping everybody, but they're winning in, you know, probably five games.
Yeah, I think the first rounds of the Western Conference are going to be really tantalizing, which is obviously not necessarily what you can say in the East. We sort of spoke about that first round series, which is going to be the most competitive. But the first rounds and the seedings that's currently unfolding, and, you know, what happens with Portland, where do they land and who do they end up versing? There'll be some teams that are wanting to tank to like that five or six, or because they just want to. And Damian Lillard, I mean, we haven't spoken much about him, but he has a chance as well to change his sort of narrative, because he was so poor in the last postseason. And CJ McCollum hopefully coming back soon enough, hopefully adds to their sort of acumen a little bit. And I mean, it transitions well to a nice little piece that we had from Gus, who was speaking about Enes Kanter and the role that he has to play for the rest of the season.
Yeah, I think Dame is, it's like almost Portland has a chip on their shoulder. I know Corey and I talked a little bit on the last NBL. We don't think they'll win a first round series, but hey, you know, Dame has the opportunity to really change that narrative. I almost think it's more so on his teammates, though, than it is on him, because we saw in that New Orleans series last year, they just took him out of the game. He was getting trapped. He was getting double teamed. They were denying him the ball. They just made his life miserable. Obviously, there's going to be no Jrue Holiday, but teams can look at that tape and be like, all right, take Dame out of it. They don't even have Nurkic this year. Yeah, we might be able to just, you know, CJ McCollum beat us, and he's coming off injury.
Exactly. Well, that's what I wanted to touch on, too. You know, if McCollum doesn't come back 100%, you don't have Nurkic, and then you have Lillard having to pretty much force offense. I think you're kind of in the same situation you were in last year, in a sense. Even though you're not getting a defender like Jrue Holiday, if Lillard has to be the source of all the offense, then they're in the same kind of predicament in a seven-game series. That's my biggest issue with Portland, is I think they're, and I constantly call them a regular season team, and I don't mean that in a sense where I just don't think they have the type of roster that's built to win four games in a seven-game series. I just don't think they do. I think they're too relied on their guard play. And when you lose a guy like Nurkic, who was having a career year, but call him a little banged up, you know, who is your number two, your number three offense? Your number
Evan Turner.
You honestly need Rodney Hood to play like he did. I don't know if you guys remember, like a few years ago in Utah, he was really, really good. He had stretches where he dropped like 25 plus, having like 30-point games, and all of a sudden it was like, holy shit, Gordon Hayward, Rodney Hood, this is going to be an amazing wing combo moving forward. Then Rodney Hood kind of just fell off a cliff and got super inconsistent. So,
yeah.
I mean, I'm not putting my eggs in a basket for Rodney Hood, and that's no offense to him. I think he's a good bench player, but I don't think he could step up in a playoff series and be that game changer.
I think Seth Curry has a little bit of a role to play. I think he's been kind of nice. Yeah, so we'll see how that happens. But I just sent you blokes in a DM this Zion block. I mean, have a look at it, and I'll just like give it some context. Kevin O'Connor put it out there. The athleticism, like we spoke about Giannis. I think that when Zion enters the league, he might already be the best athlete to enter the NBA. Now, I'm not going Colin Cowherd with this bullshit saying he's a top 20 player. But as a pure athlete and physical specimen, he's like double my weight. he's got 5 inches on me and can jump probably higher than the height of my house. That block I sent you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I'm just going to watch it about 10 times. So if I don't say anything for
outrageous.
A couple of minutes.
And for anyone that hasn't seen it, check on it. He's just I'm a Zionologist. I'm part of Zionism. Nick and I need to make some t-shirts.
It's crazy. Like, I mean, it's almost like too crazy. Like, he's so big. I've never seen somebody with that size like jump like that. It's like he springs off the ground. I would think he has no body fat percentage. Like, he has to be at probably like 2% because he's carrying no extra weight. I mean, I don't disagree with the argument that he might be the best athlete in the NBA next year, just because I think when you're that young, you're so fresh, you have really not many injuries, your body's young, you're kind of recovering like instantly on a daily basis. So I think that's not a bad take.
No, I mean, I can't remember a player having this much athletic ability coming out of college since like Blake Griffin. Like, yeah. That's like the last guy I can picture who had, and Blake Griffin didn't even play this kind of defense. That's another thing. Zion defensively is where you see some of the crazy athletic abilities. The fact, you know, he had that, the block on the closeout three.
Oh my God. And that is one of the like highlights of like the season, yeah. NBA or non NBA. He jumped from like the free throw line to the 3-point line. I'm just like, it's amazing. And like, this is why the NBA and sport in general is so wonderful and marvelous, because there's just these new wrinkles every day. It was I can't speak highly enough about it.
Yeah. I haven't watched a ton of college basketball, but I've seen some highlight packages of his perimeter defense as well. Like, his defense, I think he's instantly going to probably come and have an impact. Obviously, the small details of kind of learning an NBA defense and some of the calls are going to make differently, but he could have the direct impact. I know people have questioned a little bit his offensive game, but defensively, he looks to be like a specimen you could bring in that size. You know, you could play him at that small ball five. I don't think he's going to have a problem boxing out a lot of guys. He's just that big and that strong. It's like, I don't know what he ate as a child.
And I think this is one thing. That's true. And I think
is he like Terrio?
Well, like, it's in high school, he was like 6'3", and then he just like exploded. He got a little bit too chunky, and then like he slimmed down, and now he is just peak. I mean, I imagine getting into an NBA system, but I think as well, one underrated thing about him is that as much as he is easily the best prospect, he doesn't play with that sort of like arrogant mentality. He still tries like a mofo. Like, he is giving energy day in, day out. He's a hooper. He wants to be the best player and he wants to make an impact. And he doesn't rest on his laurels. He knows he's good, but he still plays with energy and intent and does the little things in the intangibles, which is not what you normally see from these sort of guys. You know, a lot of them will sort of coast on their talent. Zion does anything but.
Yeah.
Team player, high character too. I think that's something that, you know, you always have to take consideration, that kind of people undervalue.
I think the Nets need to start tanking now, Nick.
Jack, shut up. You know, that honestly, I think to myself sometimes, I'm like, yo, if the Nets don't make the playoffs, could God please bless us with the number one pick? Could you just bless us? Like, I know the percentages are higher this year. It still wouldn't be that high, but that would just be incredible.
Where would you – I mean, it seems to be one of the massive talking points of the NBA in general right now. Where would you guys want to see him? I know a lot of people said that, like, it's Atlanta or Dallas is the destination in terms of with the lottery odds flattening out as well. Obviously, plenty of Knicks fans want to see him in a Knicks uniform. I want to see him anywhere but Phoenix. That's basically it for me.
You go first, Corey.
I mean, I think if you're
looking... how much you love Atlanta, my friend. We know how much you love Atlanta.
Well, I do like Atlanta now. I think I've changed my tone on them quite a bit. I mean, I think Atlanta's fun because I think that him and John Collins, I think they kind of benefit each other. Obviously, Trae Young, imagine him being able to throw oops to both those guys would be absolutely phenomenal. And you look at Dallas, I think Dallas is an interesting choice too, because the fact that Porzingis isn't really a five, he's more of like a stretch four in a lot of ways. So then Zion can kind of be the bully down low in a lot of ways if he does play a small ball five. So I think that's entertaining. For me, I wouldn't want to see him in Cleveland. I wouldn't want to see him in New York. And I wouldn't want to see him in Phoenix, personally. Even though I think New York could be fun between him and Dennis Smith Jr., just the fact that they would be throwing down hammers all the time. And who knows, God forbid, maybe they do get Kevin Durant, then that becomes an entirely different thing. But I'd rather see him around a nice, young, established young core than teams that are kind of always right there.
I heard murmurings as well, just before you jump in, Nick, that he wants to play, and I'm not sure how
a small market.
Yeah, which is, there we go. Was it, did Corey leak that? What's going on there? He's working at the Athletic. Who knows what's going on there? Which is interesting because, you know, most of the guys want to go to New York, and we know that the established superstars love those big markets. But yeah, what are your thoughts, Nick? Where would you prefer to see the man himself?
I like Dallas. I think, you know, obviously with Luka, it's like, yeah, they just get two of the, you know, the best young players of the last like five drafts or whatever. Atlanta would still be fun. I think Corey brought up a great point. I probably wouldn't want to see him in like New York or Phoenix. Player development would kind of concern me, and just like a toxic environment. You know, obviously the Knicks have tried to turn that around, but there's still been a lot of talk about things. Like the whole Frank Ntilikina situation has been kind of ugly there. I don't know what's going on with him, but I think, you know, obviously the number one choice is the Nets, but I think Dallas would be pretty fun. I think that would just be an amazing young core to watch develop, and they're all young. Like, yeah. It's not even like Porzingis is old. So, and no. I think Corey brought up a great point. Porzingis and Zion would complement each other really well, and then obviously Zion, I'm assuming, is going to develop his three-point game a little bit more, obviously, in the NBA. And, you know, Kyrie brought this point up before with Jason Tatum, and people were like, wow, how'd he get so good over one offseason between, you know, being a college player and NBA player? It's like, now your full-time job is practicing basketball. You don't have to worry about anything else but basketball. So just imagine a guy with that character and work ethic having a whole offseason to work on his game.
As for Knicks fans, and this was another thing I saw on Twitter scrolling a little bit, it's been nice to be back on NBA Twitter after some heavy days at work, but there was a poll saying if for Knicks fans and for NBA fans in general, if would you prefer to have Zion and no Durant or Durant and no Zion as a Knicks fan?
I'm not a Knicks fan. I'll never be a Knicks fan, so I can't answer that. No, I'm just kidding. It's tough to say. Like, I think it would look bad for the franchise if they got KD and they essentially did nothing with him. So I think almost Zion is a little bit safer, and it puts you in a situation where like, hey guys, we don't have to rush this, you know, to a championship mode. We can let Zion, we can build around him. We have Dennis Smith Jr. We have Mitchell Robinson, you know, Kevin Knox, you know, we're not going to tank. We're going to compete, and we're going to do it the right way. And to kind of allow the franchise to actually do something, you know, the right way instead of just kind of forcing it forward.
I didn't think about it, but Mitchell Robinson and Zion would be kind of fun. Just like for rib protection purposes, dude, that would
they're
be
the only guys really I can fun. Think of like off the top of my head that are blocking threes like that. Like Mitchell Robinson doesn't get enough credit for he's blocked probably more threes than anybody in the NBA this year, if I had to make a guess at the stat, like in terms of actually jumping and blocking. Yeah. He's incredible.
He's awesome.
I'd want them to get no offense to Dennis Smith Jr., I'd want them to get more of a pure point guard if they had those two.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's hard to sort of think, you know, I think that the ideal scenario for, you know, the NBA would be Dallas getting Zion and Dallas also with their cap space using it and somehow finagling and getting Kemba Walker. Mm-hmm. That would make them like the buzz team of
the fun, exciting team that can maybe pull an upset and do something crazy.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I mean, it depends on how much you're wanting to pay Kemba Walker. That's another discussion. But I think that this offseason and what happens in the draft and going forward, it could really dictate, you know, the landscape of the NBA for the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, it's going to have a big impact on big free agents. And obviously, we haven't really talked about him as much recently because, the whole situation kind of passed. But it's going to have a big impact on where Anthony Davis lands.
Yeah, it seems like Anthony Davis is an afterthought in terms of just
crazy.
It's crazy to say that one of the most talented players in the NBA, and like, I mean, he's obviously linked to so many different teams, but because of the storylines that are currently happening at the Lakers with LeBron James and everyone else, sort of superseding what's happening with Anthony Davis, and the fact that, you know, we've got a few months, so we have to talk about that sort of stuff. But maybe once the regular season is over for the Lakers, maybe that's when it begins. Obviously, there's the whole Lonzo Ball drama as well. I mean, who would, honestly, in what world would you pay $500 for a pair of shoes that aren't an established brand in any sort of sense of the word? Like, there's such, I get the whole hype beast thing and like, you know, Supreme, cool. If you want to wear it, why not? But the whole Hypebeast thing doesn't relate to a shoe made by like this one dude in his garage. Like, just, oh my God.
It's in a no offense, Alonzo. Like, he was a good college player, but he wasn't like the best college player we've ever seen. He wasn't instantly come to the NBA and just like dominated. He still has a lot to prove in the NBA. So I thought it was just strange to launch the brand so hard like they did. And obviously they had a whole bunch of business issues. And I hate to take a shot at him, but that cover-up tattoo is absolutely atrocious. Five-sided die? Like, what?
Yeah, it's hard to cover up those BBBs. Also, I just want to throw it down on the Zion thing one more time. So what happens when the NBA rigs it and the Lakers end up getting Zion?
Oh, please.
We can take two ways. We can go talk about the Lakers and LeBron right now, or we can talk about how the Pelicans GM search is going to impact Anthony Davis trade.
I guess it's sexier to speak about the Lakers, isn't it?
Yeah, the Lakers always get some hype, obviously. Yeah. And just one quick, I took a shot at Lonzo, but I gave him a lot of props from separating from the big baller brand and doing his own thing. And it takes confidence. And obviously, he was a kid. He probably got taken advantage of by his dad. I don't know the situation. I don't know them personally. But the latest report is they had a players-only meeting, and LeBron's teammates didn't. They called him out for his body language.
I mean, I think that we saw some minor things around this with Kuzma starting to sort of get a little bit peeved at LeBron's lackadaisical nature. There was an Instagram post from some random trainer saying the truth will come out about LeBron's injury. He should never have been playing. I love LeBron. I love him like no other. He was listening to like a J. Cole song on Instagram when the whole thing of like Kobe being the great, like him saying he was the GOAT, and it was saying, you know, MJ and LeBron are equal. He just does such a good job at twisting the media narrative to his own benefit. And I think that it's going to start catching up with him sooner rather than later. If the Lakers have a poor offseason with their front office, the coaching, if they hire Jason Kidd and get no one in the offseason, like they don't get Davis, they get, you know, DeMarcus Cousins or some, you know, random free agent, then there's going to be an even more intense spotlight on the purple and gold. And that's hard to say.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen it numerous times this year. And we saw last year with Cleveland. You know, if a guy takes a bad shot or there's a bad defensive set or something, if LeBron misses his guy and someone doesn't pick up his guy, LeBron's upset. You know, the body language is a major thing. I know that times I have shitty body language. Because my friends are like, I can tell you're being an asshole by your body language. God, I'm sorry.
True. I agree. LeBron
does this, right? And then, you know, he takes those subliminal shots. He's always – and I posted the video from his story that you mentioned. Right after he posted the J. Cole stuff, he just posted a bottle of whiskey or whatever in the jar in the face. And it's just like, man, where is your head at? And then today, you know, I see a video of Miami Heat LeBron James. And now this is – maybe I'm just like reaching into something. Like when LeBron had a chip on his shoulder and like felt like he had something to prove, like I just think – everything was different. The body language, just like watch, like his body language since he won that last ring with Cleveland, the 3-1 comeback, has just not really been the same. And I know he mentioned in that one conversation with Maverick, they had that meeting. He was like, that's the ring that made me the greatest of all time. Like openly saying that. Like, I just think his entire mindset has changed. Like, he doesn't feel like he has to prove anything. He doesn't have anything to prove. Don't get me wrong. He's going to go down as one of the top two greatest players of all time. But like, it's just like a lack of accountability at this point because he's already done so much that he just thinks he's above it all in a sense is what I feel like at times. And I think like when you have all these young guys, it just sets the bad tone. Like you can't expect everyone to play and expect to like bow down to your greatness if you aren't setting the example anymore. And he used to, I feel like, set that example. And now I just think he doesn't care to set it. Like he just thinks it's, you know, I am the greatest. Like you guys can just like figure it out. I don't know if that made any sense, but that's kind of how I feel.
And I think it's the difference between playing with like a veteran team like he had in Cleveland, not to say they're all vets, some of them are still young, but having guys like Kevin Love and Kyrie Irving, who are somewhat, you know, they were established at the time, all-star players. Now you're going to a young team where some of these players don't really necessarily understand the NBA. And there's been criticisms about the Lakers organization and their player development. Like Jack and I know from D'Angelo Russell, and this isn't taking necessarily a shot at the Lakers, but he talked about coming to Brooklyn and them just being completely different organization, having things set up for them for him to understand how to be an NBA player, where these Laker players, they're so young, they don't really know what's going on. And also, you brought up a great point. I think when you're leading, you need to kind of set the tone from the start. And that's like maybe not the entire season he needs to play amazing, but the first 20 games, you need to be just going out there, diving for loose balls and just setting the tone in every way possible.
I think the turning point for me wasn't necessarily the chip, the greatest comeback maybe in the history, not in this, even a basketball, but a sport, was game one of last year's finals, when that was one of the most phenomenal playoff performances, basketball performances I've ever seen. And a lot of other people have, you know, I'm not the only one saying it, yet it was one little blunder that changed it all and changed the entire tone. I mean, we know he loves, the dude loves his Henny, but apparently doesn't love it that much. But I think that was the turning point for him in terms of the fact that, you know, we sort of spoke about Zion, you know, not resting on his laurels. I think LeBron is doing that a little bit, Corey, like you sort of alluded to. And he needs, you know, whether it's another vet or just something else to give him that spark to sort of get that motivation back. Normally, you don't need that, you know, external motivation if you're an athlete. But when you've been doing this for 20 years, the grind is there, and, you know you don't, there's no realistic chance of being a competitor of to, you know, this dynasty right now. Whereas next season, if, you know, they get a couple of free agents here and there, they get a decent coach who, you know, LeBron respects and is on a decent level with, and that's one thing, like, he's never had a coach other than Eric Spoelstra who has necessarily held him accountable, and even then it's generally LeBron and the rest of the organization, and that's still the case with the Lakers, despite the fact that they have this mystique right now. And, you know, didn't he blow like a raspberry in reference to the fact that of the moves that were made in the offseason? So he loves being able to twist everything to benefit him the most. And LeBron James is the reason why I follow basketball. But I think to be an unbiased sort of observer, he's twisting things a little bit too much in the sense where it just makes him look better than he actually really is right now.
Like, something that's driven me crazy the last like month or so is the fact that obviously the Lakers are playing for nothing. And I get like, you're still like, you know, you're still playing and whatever, but like him, like dancing after like certain layups and dunks and like flaunt, like I don't know. I just like, it just, I don't know. It just rubs me the wrong way, I guess. Cause you got 32 wins and like the season was an absolute failure. But I'm not saying like, don't have fun playing basketball. Like, I'm kind of like torn on this. There's just certain things he does where it's just like where's your head? And I guess that's what just frustrates me. Because as you mentioned, Jack, I was a big LeBron hater. And that, like, last year in Miami, even though they lost to the Spurs, and then when he went back to Cleveland, like, I fell in love with him. Like, he became, like, the greatest player of all time in my eyes, and everything changed. But that killer mentality just isn't there anymore for me. And I don't know, it just bothers me.
You think if they got Anthony Davis at the trade deadline, that this, we'd be having a completely different conversation, and the Lakers would be in the playoffs, and LeBron would probably be competing at a higher level? Because with AD, they would probably have a chance, at least a chance, to beat anyone in the playoff series. Not saying they would, but it would just give them the possibility. If you have, you know, it's kind of like Kyrie and LeBron when they were just kind of carrying those Cavs teams. Not to say the other guys didn't step up, but when you have two superstars at that level, it can kind of send you to a different thing. So I think LeBron at that point was like, yo, this team ain't going to do it. Like, we're not going to do anything. We'll make the playoffs. We'll probably get swept in the first round. That might even hurt me more than if I missed the playoffs. So, like, yo, let's try to force this trade for AD. Do everything we can. We obviously know his ties with the agent and his agency.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. This sort of season is going to be a blip on the radar in terms of LeBron James's resume, the injuries, the Lakers in general. But next season is going to be telling in terms of, we spoke about, like, in so many different ways, you know, the NBA landscape is going to be different. But for LeBron James and in his individual legacy and the Lakers' legacy, it's going to be insane what happens. And it's going to be absolutely wild. And I think beyond that, because, you know, the 2020 class is absolutely putrid. If nothing happens this season, then LeBron James is going to have to go, look, I'm going to have to go like Cleveland 2016, 17, 15, 16 mode and do this all myself.
And but can he do it at that?
I don't think he can.
Is he in, like, you know, and I think that this is probably a poor comparison, but we make it because it's the GOAT sort of conversation. Is he now in, you know, MJ Wizards mode, so to speak, with the Lakers right now? Not necessarily as bad and as old and as poor, but is his rise, his stranglehold on the NBA that we've been spoken about earlier, is that gone? It seems to be closer and closer to the fact that it's going to happen.
It feels like him and KD are playing tug of war right now, in a sense, where KD's playing like the best player. You can make the argument for Giannis, and LeBron's getting pulled, and it looks like he might just kind of tip over at this point. So it's something to consider, and I always think this is a kind of an argument that's never brought up for like the MJ versus LeBron thing. MJ retired. He got time off. He played baseball. That's cool. He played in the minor leagues, but the physical toll it takes on your body to play baseball and basketball is completely different. So I think like asking LeBron to keep carrying it over, especially with all the finals trips, like you talked about the physical fatigue, like, yo, he went to the finals 8 straight years. Like, that's so many games. And we talked about how he had to carry the teams, like putting up 50 against the Warriors, which I don't know if anybody in the NBA could have done that last season.
No. And just like, I mean, if you think about that entire playoff run in general, I mean, it was that first round series against the Pacers was not easy for LeBron. He had to have a game winner. He had to carry the load. I mean, the Raptors, they did what they always do to the Raptors. But then against the Celtics, that obviously was a slugfest for 7 games against, you know, a bunch of, you know, rookies and nobodies for a lot of it.
A lot of gritty players, though. They just weren't going to make LeBron earn it. And I felt like they did. So, I mean, hey,
you guys mentioned the stranglehold, and I just want to say this. And, you know, I think if the Lakers don't get a star or some kind of superstar this offseason, and we get this run it back type of team with the Lakers, that stranglehold is gone. I mean, the stranglehold already. The stranglehold, Cam's hoping.
Kill Cam.
Because I think if you don't get a star, then it also just signals that everybody's kind of like LeBron's got 1 foot out of the door already, in a sense. Because why would you not want to play with a once like a all-time great player if you don't think you can win with him, in a sense? And, you know, the bad teammate report that we're talking about that came out, I don't think that necessarily is a great sign either for guys who may want to come play with them. So this offseason, as you mentioned, Jack, is going to be really telling for a lot of things.
And as good as LeBron is, there's still an argument to be made that, like, hey, there's other destinations where I'll have a better chance to win that's not in L.A. Like, LeBron's amazing, but, hey, do I question the rest of the team? Do I question if they can stay on the floor and can they contribute to winning basketball? I think that's still a concern. Like, Kyle Kuzma's putting up great numbers, but is he contributing to winning basketball? Do we know that? No. Can Lonzo stay on the court? Do we know that? I don't know. Josh Hart obviously had an injury this year as well, so there's a lot of question marks, not just with LeBron, the entire Lakers team and organization.
Yeah, ownership.
Jerry West having a nice little celebratory dinner and such after making that Zubac trade. Good on him.
Dude, like, yeah. What? Like, dude, other GMs are laughing at you for trading away a young player for nothing. Like, what are we doing here?
You traded away Zubac, and you thought the answer to win a chip was Lance Stephenson, JaVale McGee, and Michael Beasley.
You guys, you specifically, Corey, were higher on Lance than I was. I remember doing a specific free agency pod on the outlet, yeah. And you were so much higher on Lance, and the fact that he's stepping on blokes' feet to make his crossovers these days. Like, please.
Oh God, I like that's a pet peeve of mine. When a guy crosses somebody up and he gets tripped or stepped on and they still blow it up, like, yo, he just crossed him up. Like, dude, he literally tripped him. Like, how is he supposed to keep his balance? Like, if I did that to you in real life, you'd probably call the cops. Like,
I just want to say for the Lance Stephenson, he hasn't really got I'm kind of like distancing myself from because of the rumors and the Tina Trump stuff. That's kind of like a woof. But he really hasn't gotten the minutes, you know?
If I could roll away any farther, my headphones weren't attached to be in the other room right now.
You're lucky I'm in Australia, bro. Or else I'm buying it. I'm heading there soon, my dude. I'm heading there soon. Oh, please.
I feel pretty good because I wasn't even high on the Lakers. I think I had them as like 7th or 8th seed in the Western Conference predictions. And
I picked them 4th.
Yeah, they're just... I just think the roster never was assembled great, and Magic Johnson and Rob Pelinka deserve way more hate than they're getting. We hating LeBron a lot. Like, that team is not a good – it's like if you're putting a 2K roster together and you're giving it to, like, an 8th grader that hasn't watched a ton of NBA and they're just basing it off ratings that they're seeing. Like, oh, this guy's an 80. Let's add him to the squad. He's a 75. Don't worry about fit. You know, we'll figure it out on the court. Like, if you don't have 3-point shooters in the NBA nowadays, you're not really winning. Like, look at all the top teams we talked about today. We talked about Houston. We talked about Golden State. We talked about Toronto. We talked about Milwaukee. All these teams can space the floor.
And that's the model that has worked before. It has proven results. And yet Magic's like, nah, Lance Stephenson and Rajon Rondo is a much better way of going about things.
Yeah, Michael Beasley can replace whatever we need. Like, he's going to replace Julius Randle's production. Like, yeah, we'll just trade away our players. Don't worry about it. We're the Lakers. Whatever. I think it's just, it's kind of gets Lakers for some karma, like all their fans thinking they're going to get Russell Westbrook, Kevin Love, all these players, Paul George, Kawhi Leonard for like the last 10 years. And hey guys, it's not as easy as it seems. That name doesn't sell quite as hard as it used to.
I think that's going to be incredibly telling. You know, Rob Pelinka's parables about Taylor Swift and whatever it might be and introducing KCP. We've sort of heard, and we've sort of, I think there was a poll recently in terms of what, on OTG, what is the big sort of the biggest deciding factor in terms of wanting to head to an organization? And is it front office stability? Is it chemistry? And a lot of different responses. I think the front office is underrated. Now, obviously, ownership is known. We know how bad, you know, the Knicks are with James Dolan, how bad the Suns are with Robert Sarver. But, you know, the best teams in the NBA have good front offices. You know, the Houston Rockets with Daryl Morey, the Boston Celtics with Danny Ainge. And it's not just, you know, one season success. It's sustained success. Sam Presti and OKC, despite the fact that they've only had Russell Westbrook and KD left, they've maintained themselves as a playoff contender in an absolutely stacked Western Conference. You know, the Clippers making that change. You know, they're literal next-door neighbors, the guys that are in their own city, you know, getting Jerry West and spending, I think Steve Ballmer is spending inordinate amounts of money on just having extra staff around because there's no cap on that. You can spend as much as you want on having assistant coaches, having inside guys. And I think that that is one thing in all of sport. And I know in a lot of other sports, there is a cap on that. But in the NBA, I think if you're an owner and you want to have a competitive advantage, that's where you can really get it. You know, insiders, coaches, and sports scientists, trainers, investing there is going to what's going to attract you to free agents and the rest.
And Jack, we could talk about it firsthand. The Nets, the viewpoint on the Nets from where their previous front office, Billy King and, you know, company compared to Sean Marks, they took all the extra time. They brought in the extra staff, the extra team. They probably quadrupled the amount of people they have working for the Nets organization, just doing the small details. And that's the stuff that players appreciate. You know, like, I think the big market and all this stuff is a little bit over exaggerated just because social media can expose you to so much more than in the past. Like, hey, if you're not living in LA or New York, you're not getting the publicity. Hey, if I have 10 million followers, I'm still going to get, you know, my, my points to these people.
Yeah, exactly. I think that, there's a lot. I think that how Jeannie Buss, you know, navigates this going forward, you know, the coach, the front office, what is the plan, you know, in terms of, LeBron is there for the next 3-4 years. What is your plan to maximize success in that 3 to 4 years with LeBron James? Because we've already seen him waning, and I think he's almost got another little tidbit in relation to LeBron James. He's almost got an eye on just waiting for Bronny and where he's going to land so he can verse him or be on the same team. And I don't buy into the fact that, yes, he's got all these media ventures and cool, that's fine. He's sort of set the standard in terms of having that player free agency in terms of to do whatever they want on and off the court. But I think his eye isn't necessary. His motivation isn't on the court as much as it was in the past. Because like Corey said, he's proved it. And I think that that ring, as we sort of spoke about, speaks greater than, you know, many others.
All right, guys, before we go into, you know, midnight on here, any final thoughts?
I like talking about basketball.
And just a quick shout out, we will be doing a live show very soon, so keep an eye out for that. And that means we'll be in person. We'll give you some video, yeah, with some audio, all types of crazy stuff. And I'm sure Corey and Jack will be making some bets about things. I don't know, but I'm just putting it out there.
Okay, all right.
As always, thank everybody for listening. Check us out, iTunes, Spock Talk Radio, OTGBasketball.com, Google Play, Dash Radio, and YouTube.
Peace.